Can you hear me?
Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to our program here at the Perimeter Institute. My name is Ivan Semenik, Chief of Correspondence for Nature. And what we have in store for you today is both an exploration and a celebration of the words and ideas of Stephen Hawking. Of course, Professor Hawking's groundbreaking cosmology and his research has transformed theoretical physics for over 40 years. As a popularizer of science, he's one of the most recognized personalities on Earth. His story touches all of us. It brings us here together this evening. And joining us tonight, we have a panel of special guests. But first, before we get to our conversation, we're going to reacquaint ourselves with the man who's the focus of our celebration. So we've prepared something for you. Without further ado, here we have a brief history of Stephen Hawking.
Professor Stephen Hawking was born January 1942 in Oxford, England, 300 years to the day after Galileo's death.
Galileo, perhaps more than any other single person, Galileo was responsible for the birth of modern science.
Stephen Hawking is the most renowned physicist since Einstein, which was his nickname at the St. Albans Girls' School, which he attended. Even though some of his classmates did not believe he could possibly do well, they were wrong. He is one of the most recognized and celebrated scientists of his era.
The downside of my celebrity is that I cannot go anywhere in the world without being recognized. It is not enough for me to wear dark sunglasses and a wig. The wheelchair gives me away.
In a career that has spanned 40 years, he's written books. His first book sold over 20 million copies. He's a ubiquitous presence on the air, with hundreds of TV appearances, including some of the most popular shows of our time.
Life would be tragic if it weren't funny.
For 30 years, he was Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics at Cambridge, the post once held by Isaac Newton. He has spent his career looking for the answer to big questions.
My goal is simple. It is a complete understanding of the universe, why it is as it is, why it exists at all.
And he's a Capricorn who loves curry but is not particularly fond of Schrodinger's cat.
When I hear mention of Schrodinger's cat, I want to reach for my gun.
Stephen Hawking. And although he can no longer speak, having lost the ability to do so in 1985, he has one of the most recognized voices the world over, courtesy of his voice synthesizer.
For millions of years, mankind lived just like the animals. Then something happened which unleashed the power of our imagination. We learned to talk and we learned to listen. Speech has allowed the communication of ideas, enabling human beings to work together to build the impossible. Mankind's greatest achievements have come about by talking, and its greatest failures by not talking. It doesn't have to be like this. Our greatest hopes could become reality in the future. With the technology at our disposal, the possibilities are unbounded. All we need to do is make sure we keep talking, keep talking, keep talking, keep talking, keep talking.
Stephen Hawking. His name adorns buildings around the world, and now a complete center for research, training, and outreach at the Perimeter Institute in Ontario, Canada. He even has an asteroid named after him. Oh, and he's done a bit of science in his spare time. His principal fields of research have been theoretical cosmology and quantum gravity.
What I have done is to show that it is possible for the way the universe began to be determined by the laws of science.
And he is most renowned for his work on the Big Bang singularity and the quantum nature of black holes.
Science.
He helped prove that we must go beyond Einstein, and the discovery of Hawking radiation pointed the way.
Science.
It was the first really concrete step towards quantum gravity,
the tying together of Einstein's theory of gravity and quantum theory. His other scientific investigations have included. And he's done all this while being challenged by a motor neuron disease known as ALS, which he has lived with for 40 years.
My expectations were reduced to zero when I was 21. Everything since then has been a bonus.
Everything since then has been a bonus for all of us. Well, a great reintroduction to Stephen Hawking. Of course, partway through, you heard his words to us, keep talking, so we're going to keep talking today. We're going to take his advice. But first, we're going to introduce our panel. So joining us here today, we have Dr. Jim Gates. He is the John S. Toll Professor of Physics at the University of Maryland, College Park. That's where he's known for his work on supersymmetry and string theory. He's also serving on President Barack Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. Dr. Rebecca Sachs is an Associate Professor of Cognitive Science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Among other questions, her work touches on how the brain constructs abstract thoughts. Julie Payette is a Canadian astronaut who has twice journeyed into orbit. She spent a total of 25 days in space, and just yesterday she received the Order of Canada. Congratulations, Julie. And finally, Dr. Neil Turek is a cosmologist and director of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, our host here. He's also a longtime friend and colleague of Stephen Hawking. And just a note also to our viewing audience, Dr. Brian Green, who is also scheduled to be with us today, sends his regrets. He was not able to join us. But Neil, I want to come back to you. We've just had a chance to once again see the public face of Stephen Hawking and the impact he's had in the world. You know Stephen well, you've worked with him. I would like, is there a story that brings us a little bit closer? Give us your experience of your Stephen Hawking.
So, yeah, the one thing I would say is that the more you know Stephen, the more remarkable he is. It's almost impossible to understand. But you see, his physical condition is seemingly impossible, and yet he just seems blind to it. I mean, he is the ultimate story of mind over matter. And I can tell you, you know, many different stories about this, but maybe one of them, which was quite dramatic. A few years ago, he has a hole in his throat that he breathes out of. And he had a plastic device inserted to stop food going into his lungs, essentially. And this was slowly eating through his windpipe. It was discovered by doctors. The doctors who found it said, "You're too weak for us to operate on you. We can't really see any solution." Well, he traveled a lot around the world to give lectures. And he happened to meet on an airplane somebody who was a surgeon who said, "Oh no, I can do something about that." And so thank God Stephen travels a lot. And so he went into hospital and had the operation, and you can tell it was a very, very risky operation. So I went to visit him in hospital afterwards. And the only time I've known him for 13 years, the only time I've ever known him to be at all somber, he said to me, "I nearly died." And, you know, it was that close. And we sort of sat there and paused and contemplated that for a while. And then he said, "Now let's talk physics." And that's always his way. That was the longest pause I ever had. Normally, he would just change any subject. "Okay, let's start talking about physics."
Right.
It's just unbelievable.
Well, a remarkable character, a unique character in physics, as you say. But I guess he shares something with you and all theoretical physicists, which is this burning question now, this desire to answer the big question that's emerging. The question of whether there's a theory of everything, whether there's a unified theory that explains the entire universe. This is one of the big challenges of physics today.
Right.
Now, for our audience, in the program today, we're also going to hear from Stephen Hawking from time to time, and this is our first occasion to do so. So right now, we're going to hear from Stephen Hawking himself on the quest to find a unified theory and what it would mean to discover such a theory. So here, let's listen.
The discovery of a complete unified theory may not aid the survival of our species. It may not even affect our lifestyle. But ever since the dawn of civilization, people have not been content to see events as unconnected and inexplicable. They have craved an understanding of the underlying order in the world. Today we still yearn to know why we are here, and where we came from. Humanity's deepest desire for knowledge is justification enough for our continuing quest. And our goal is nothing less than a complete description of the universe we live in.
Okay.
Okay.
Count to five for us.
Great.
Just count to five. 4, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And lift off.
That's
good. what do you hear? Keep going, keep talking for us. We're not hearing.
You're doing a great job.
Thanks very much. You're an inspiration.
Probably came unplugged.
That's correct.
It's the Perimeter Institute.
Thanks to Stephen Hawking's theories, we've discovered how to freeze time. At this moment, the clock has stopped.
I need to continue talking. I need to continue saying something. Maybe you could ask me a question soon. Let's see, babbling.
Yes.
Food
on space. What's your favorite food on space? In space. Excellent.
Keep talking, Julie.
That was a good question.
Okay. Actually, it's the same food as my 8-year-old macaroni and cheese. Dehydrated.
I think it's sort of.
Keep talking.
No, Julie's on the phone.
No.
Is that okay?
And when you're not in space, do you like to cook?
Macaroni and cheese.
No. Macaroni and cheese. Wonderful.
Neil, count to five for us. Count to five for us.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, we're good.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Now, tell us what you had for lunch.
I had lovely lunch with the crew of TVO, which I was not supposed to have, considering I'm not on a TVO panel.
And it was not macaroni and cheese.
It was very good. We will get through this problem.
This is an institute for theoretical physics.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
I have too much.
No, if we switch to quantum, it would be fine.
I think I have a lapel backup.
Guys, talk to us, please. Sorry, Julie, talk to us again.
Oh, I have to continue talking?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm talking. My kids, no. What can I talk about? We're good.
Yeah.
We're good.
Okay, this is great.
Okay, we're good.
Wonderful. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you. Now, what were we talking about?
Physics.
Stephen Hawking. So. Theory of everything.
Yeah. Okay, that's great.
I'll count you. 5, 4, 3, 2.
And there we go, a goal that's nothing short than a complete understanding of the universe and everything in it. Now, that's an ambitious goal. So Jim, I'm going to turn to you, and I want you to unpack this a little bit for us, this goal of the unified theory. First of all, what is it that needs to be unified?
Well, you know, I think probably the thing that needs to be unified is our understanding of the universe. Because as we've come as creatures to understand this place in which we live, it's a piecemeal process. We learn a little bit of this, we learn a little bit of that, and it's a rather chaotic process. But in physics, we, for the last several hundred years, have understood that at the end, it all comes together in a unified picture. That is, the first unification was electricity and magnetism were related. And out of that understanding came television, radio, all of this wonderful technology that we now take for, you know, just take for granted. If you look at science right now, what we understand most and least, gravity in some sense least, all the other forces pretty well. And so this last unification is to bring together gravity and the other forces. And just like earlier when we understood that electricity and magnetism were related and it led to TV, just think of what's going to happen now when we take gravity and put it together with the other forces. Mm-hmm. It likely will lead to a new understanding, I think, of information. And that's the kind of science that we need to propel our species for the next millennium.
I was waiting to find out what's better than TV, so you've answered that question. And this idea that basically out of complexity that there's simplicity, which may be a bit counterintuitive. You know, most people think of theoretical physics as the most complex thing, but in fact, at the heart of it, there's this, I guess, inner simplicity that's being looked for. Neil, I have to ask you, I guess this is a question close to your heart, how close are we to getting to this final theory?
Well, I have to tell a story about Stephen. When I was an undergraduate at Cambridge, I went to Stephen's inaugural lecture as the Lucasian professor. And the title of it was typically provocative. It was, "Is the End of Theoretical Physics in Sight?" And the lecture basically consisted of little jokes and quips by Stephen. But the heart of it, he predicted that a certain theory called supergravity, based in 11 dimensions of space and time, was in fact the ultimate theory of everything. And so it was incredibly bold statement that he was making. And as a young physicist, I was completely skeptical, I have to say. later on, you know, I went off and I came back to Cambridge as a professor. And Stephen told us one day he wanted to give a second lecture on this topic. And the title was going to be, "Is the End of Theoretical Physics Finally in Sight?" And in that lecture, he said, 20 years ago, I made the prediction that the end was in sight. He said, "I still believe that, but the clock starts, I still believe we will discover it within 20 years, but the clock starts now." And that was typically Stephen, too, very, very optimistic and positive. But what happened was, he put his money on this particular theory, and over the succeeding 30 years, this theory has indeed emerged as the most fundamental viewpoint we have on string theory, on unification of forces. It's been incredibly productive mathematically. New concepts like brains, which affect my own work on the beginning of the universe and the Big Bang. So his insight was to see the idea that would in fact be the most fruitful. Right. Even though we are still have not succeeded in our quest.
And plenty of work to do.
Yep.
Rebecca, I want to turn to you for your expertise, because it's not just a goal to uncover this theory, but in fact, as we heard in Stephen Hawking's own words, there's a yearning. He speaks about a yearning, this idea of putting the pieces together. The brain is an incredible organ. It can do many things. This is what you study. But where does the yearning come from? Why does the brain want to understand?
Right, and that's something it is to have not just any brain, but a specifically human brain, right? Different species with different kinds of brains take different strategies towards survival, and some species survive by producing many simple babies and just hoping that a few of them will survive, and some species survive by producing one baby that's born incredibly competent. And we survived by producing a very small number of totally incompetent children and trusting that what they will do is have big brains that will allow them to learn whatever they need to know in the world that they find themselves in. So it's by adaptation and by learning that our species has taken the strategy of survival, and that instinct always to learn in the current environment, to learn a new thing, starts from the moment we're born and carries us all the way here.
I think it's still spectacular that among those new things can be this incredibly abstract way of looking at the universe. But, and of course, I think Stephen Hawking was speaking for all of us when he was saying that we have this desire to understand. You know, Julie, I want to ask you about this as well, because in your work, in your career, you've sort of come to symbolize, in a sense, humanity at the frontier of science and technology, you know, just as theoretical physics is at the frontier of human thought. But, you know, I think we have to recognize that until recently, these are also pursuits that were mainly limited to men, for example, that there was a smaller group of people that were doing this. It wasn't necessarily something that everyone did. So first of all, how can we have more women in this pursuit? How can we inspire more people to plunge into these ideas and pursue these frontiers?
Well, it's an excellent question, particularly in physics, which we know is a world that has had limited success at wooing women in its faculties. There's no real answer to that, and there's many factors at play, but we understand that, indeed, part of it is cultural. Part of it is the way the mechanisms are within the universities, the structure, the academic world that may not foster the retention of people. Clearly, physics is open to everybody. There is no discrimination about studying this particular field. And a lot of women, but also people from all walks of life, are interested in participating in that world. And the more we recruit, and I think here at the Perimeter Institute, there's a particular effort in a very vast array, then the more that is not going to be an issue anymore, because with numbers comes that diversity.
Is there a special moment, Neil, where you capture that inspiration or where that brings a young person in to tackling these ideas?
It's continuous all the way through school, but we notice here, so at Perimeter we run a master's program, and we notice very clearly that I think at the end of undergrad, people are asking questions about where am I going with my life? And that's a particularly important place to intervene and to encourage women to say, you know, fields like physics are welcoming and you're important and you have potential. So our master's program in particular is designed to be extremely welcoming and to view, we were discussing this earlier, to view people for their potential, not for their actual achievements in exams. Because a simple fact is that a woman or somebody from a disadvantaged background has had to struggle through a lot more in order to get where they are. And one has to recognize that and see that if they were provided with a supportive environment and a fantastic opportunity, they might be able to do great things. And that's how we try to select people on the basis of their potential.
Right. Now I want to return now to Stephen Hawking and his own pursuit. You know, of course, he's well known for asking some of these how questions about the universe. Most physicists are asking how questions. How do atoms work and stars and galaxies? Maybe something that Stephen Hawking is also known for, though, is pursuing the why questions, maybe to go to that deeper level of curiosity. So once again, let's hear from Stephen Hawking in his own words about going to that deeper level of question. Here we go.
Even if there is only one possible unified theory, it is just a set of rules and equations. What is it that breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe? The usual approach of science of constructing a mathematical model cannot answer the questions of why there should be a universe for the model to describe. Why does the universe go to all the bother of existing?
That's a great question. Why does the universe go to the bother of existing? Jim, I'm coming back to you with this one.
Thank you for giving me the easy one.
I'm not going to ask you to answer the question. I'm going to ask you, is this a question that physics can even tackle? Are there some things that are beyond science? Why do we have a universe instead of, you know, why do we have something instead of nothing? That
sure.
Classic question.
First of all, at a definitive level, I don't think physics can answer the question about why we have it. Those of us like Neil and myself who pursue this for a lifetime get a glimmer. And, you know, sometimes when people ask the question, I say, well, the universe exists because it's fun. Right? The universe wants to exist because it wants to have fun. Well, you know, that's an answer. That's not quite right. But for those, for more our more serious thought, when we look at the universe and we think very much about it, it looks like it is some sort of construction whose purpose is to explore the realm of possibilities. That's the best way I know how to say what I've seen after 30 years of pursuing theoretical physics. Einstein said something like this, that at the end of the day, when you look at the work of some of the most accomplished physicists, and in his case, of course, he was talking about himself, but he didn't use the word accomplished, of course, he's much more modest. But he said that at the end, one is left with a sense of mystery, that there's something very deep and subtle about the universe in which we exist, and that this mystery is perhaps the greatest gift given to our species.
So if pursuing the mystery part of what it means to have a universe, that it's something that, is the universe in the process of sorting itself out through us?
Actually, that's something that personally I believe. I mean, I've been known to say that our purpose in the universe is to actually witness it, to provide witness to what is going on in this vastly complicated arena in which we all live, and of which we are part. We are connected to the universe in ways that are profound and almost unfathomable. One of my heroes was Carl Sagan, who liked to say we're all star stuff, because there are parts in our bodies that were cooked up in the explosions of stars. In my generation and Neil's generation of physicists, we spent a lot of time looking at this thing called string theory. And one of the strange things that philosophically I almost never hear discussed in string theory is that it actually says not only are we connected to the stars, but we're actually somehow connected to space and time at a level that no one could ever conceive. And it's in there in our mathematics. And so we humans are connected to this universe at a level that is far more subtle than we have thought about outside of science. But in science, the stories are so powerfully there that we, even those of us who might not want to hear this story about being connected to all the people around us or the universe in which we live, our science brings this story back to us.
That's great. Well, now, speaking of connected to the universe, we're about to hear from someone who's very well connected to the universe. Stephen Hawking's explorations, of course, have earned him many admirers around the world. So we're going to hear from some of them today and now. Maybe the one who's the most connected to the universe of all, someone you'll recognize.
Hello, I'm William Shatner, and I want to say hi and welcome. I have a thought. Humans have been classed as toolmakers, but who's the genius that theorized the wheel or the use of fire or the planting of a seed? Those are the people whose minds conceived the theories most critical to the formation of what we call civilization. Hey, we can't stop now. We need new theories to save us from some of the old theories. The Stephen Hawking Center might help. God, I hope so.
There we go. Okay, this is a tough act to follow, Neil, but I think there's a really interesting point there. There's definitely an interesting point there. The power of theory. What is it? What is the power of theory?
Well, I have a way of saying it. It's just magic that works. And, you know, yesterday we announced our appointment of the Isaac Newton Chair here. And so in preparing for that, obviously I've been thinking about Newton, and he's the founder of modern science in many ways. But Newton came from a background, actually John Maynard Keynes discovered or bought a box of Newton's old papers. And within the, he read all these papers, and he concluded that Newton was the last of the magicians. He was interested in the Sumerians and the Babylonians and all the mysteries they wondered about. That's what drove Newton. And he spent half of his life on alchemy and ultimately died of mercury poisoning through all of his experiments in alchemy. He never succeeded in making gold. And he spent the other half on mathematics and understanding the universe. And the physics was the part of his magic that worked. And we still have no clue why it works. Why does maths and why does this description work? But it does. And so it's kind of like a Pandora's box. I mean, once you open this and begin to realize what makes the universe tick, it's incredibly powerful. And where it will lead us, we don't know. But I very much share Jim's philosophy that this is one of the most, you know, important things for humanity to do. In a sense, we are here to do this, to figure out how it works.
Wow. And speaking of how it works, so Julie, you know, I'm just thinking again of your career, and you know, we can say astronaut in a fairly casual way, but just remember, you know, two generations ago, this would have been inconceivable. It would have been a question whether such things were possible. So, you know, there you are on the frontier of technology. Here at Perimeter and around the world, there are people on the frontiers of human knowledge and the theoretical side. What's the connection in your mind between sort of those ideas, the power of those ideas, and what actually takes us, you know, to new technologies, to new horizons?
Well, that's a great question, but the it's absolutely clear that without the theoretical physics, without the thinkers, those that build the theories and understood and were the first ones to express how that knowledge could be put to use, then nothing else is possible. There's no computers, there's no telescopes, and there's no spaceship for professional spacecraft operators to operate. Mm-hmm. So you need that knowledge to go further. And we're actually counting on you guys tremendously because we like to go further. And the problem with physics right now, there's a number, is that things are really far. If we go to the next star at the current speed where we use our spacecraft right now, you know, give or take 400,000 years, well, clearly, I'd volunteer to be the last generation of those 400,000 years to get to the star. So there's a few things you need to solve. Absolutely. So that we can go further.
We're working on it.
There you go.
I have to tell you, one of the things that, to this point, one of the things that I've often said to people is that the first person to figure out if it's possible to build one of those James Tiberius Kirk starships, right, is likely to be someone studying the equations of something like string theory.
Mm-hmm. So,
or quantum gravity. It's going to be a theorist,
right,
that first figures out how you build a starship.
Right. Is this a personal motivation? Do you have someplace you need to be?
Well, no, I have a little planet that I've heard has a star that has diamonds around it. That's what I'm going for.
The diamond planet. And we'll call you Diamond Jim. So that's great. So here we have, of course, the power of the imagination and the power of the imagination realized in all of these practical ways. So, there's another amazing thing about this, not just that physics works, but that we can do it at all, that it is actually something that we as humans can do, that we can somehow unlock these secrets. Once again, let's turn to Stephen Hawking in his own words to talk about this pursuit and how it is that we do this.
We are just an advanced breed of monkeys on a minor planet of a very average star. But we can understand the universe. That makes us something very special.
Now, Rebecca Sachs, a taxonomist might argue if we're really monkeys or not, but we're related to monkeys. We're related to monkeys. And I think this really is a really interesting question, the fact that not only are we decoding the universe in some form, but that the universe is somehow available for the human mind to decode. You know, Stephen Hawking is talking about us as sort of monkeys on this planet. But, you know, a monkey's brain presumably is meant for a monkey to survive. Why is it that a human brain also allows theoretical physics? Is there anything in brain science today that helps us understand why we can even do this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the part of the question that seems in some ways most amazing is the capacity for abstract thought. The fact that we can think about things that go way beyond the objects, the colors, sensations that are in front of us, and imagine first things are absent, then things that are maybe impossible. And I think actually Stephen Hawking had a very deep insight when he said, what expands the possibility of imagination is the capacity for language. So human language, unlike any other communication system of any species, lets us refer not only to what's happening right here and right now, but also to the impossible, the imaginary, the future, as well as the past. And so I think the initial understanding of the human capacity for abstract thought will come from understanding the human capacity for language.
I want to go just a little step further with you. I mean, is there a change that took place? Because we don't see a lot of other creatures on Earth doing this right now. Is it something that appeared gradually in our species? Is there something that we can point to?
Well, it's hard to point to it. Well, we can point to where it is in the brain, but actually referring to what you said before, not to why.
Right. So, but there's a region of the brain that lights up when physicists do their thing?
Oh, there's a lot of regions of the brain
okay.
that lights up. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk about that some more. I want to explore this further, but I actually would like to hear from Stephen Hawking some more, because he's also talked about the experience that you're describing, but from the inside. What does it feel like to actually be doing physics, and especially what does it feel like to make a discovery that's entirely new? So here we go.
There's nothing like the eureka moment of discovering something that no one knew before. I won't compare it to sex, but it lasts longer.
Okay, so...
And that's actually a theory of explanation, of the function of explanation. This is a real scientific theory, that the function
physics
of...
Physics and sex.
sort of. Right. So the theory is, well, people pursue sex for orgasm because it feels good, and that has the positive consequence of reproduction. And similarly, we pursue eureka moments, the really good feeling of having figured something out, right, because it has the positive side effects of giving us the right theories that let us control the world and build spaceships.
Jim, how does this square with your experience of doing physics?
Well... I would tell you a personal story, but I'm not. However, one of the things that all of us who have pursued science and gotten to those eureka moments, and they're very few, and in an entire lifetime, you're lucky if you get 3 to 5 of them. But all of us, I think, who become theorists, start off with a dream that we want to discover a mathematically working piece of magic that is also simultaneously describing something in nature. And if you're lucky enough to get that to occur in your life, it's that special eureka moment. And the only thing that, well, Stephen picked one thing that I can describe is comparable, but the only other thing that I know that is comparable to that moment is if one is fortunate enough to be a parent and you look at your child, and the first time the child recognizes you back, that is a moment you will never forget. And it's like that. Hmm. That's what the eureka moment feels like.
Right. Wow. And Julie, I want to ask you about another side of this, because we've been talking about the pleasure of this exploration. We've been talking about sort of what's pulling us forward. But we know that in any pursuit, in any kind of pushing out into new territory, there's also risk. I mean, in your work, you've encountered real physical risk. So how is it that we also overcome risk on our way to pursuing new goals, to going where people haven't gone before?
Because we are completely and utterly curious, and we absolutely want, it's intrinsic to the human nature to push the frontier of the known world, or the furthest that we've been, or the fastest that we've gone, or the highest that we've climbed. There's always someone that wants to push that border, and that is so important that it risk. secondary. We will take the risk, understand it as best as possible, mitigate it by training, by having good equipment, and by learning lessons from other people. However, we will never stop trying to push wherever that frontier is. If there was another Everest that had not been conquered on Earth, there would be a horde of people trying to climb it. And that pleasure probably is very similar to the pleasure Rebecca was talking about. It's to be there at the highest, at the fastest, first one to go somewhere where no one else has been before.
Well, this is so appropriate when we're talking about Stephen Hawking, because I think one of the things that makes his story so touching is that he has, and so compelling, is that he's pushed forward with these achievements, incredible achievements, in spite of some significant physical challenges. So now we're going to hear from another one of Stephen Hawking's many fans from around the world, someone who also understands that drive in spite of challenges.
Good evening, everyone. Stephen Hawking is an incredible human being on so many dimensions. First of all, of course, because of his brilliance, such a great scientist and thinker of possibilities, of filling in gaps of human knowledge and insight. Probably most importantly, as an incredible human being who faced adversity, who looked at a challenge and thought, what can I do with this? It's not what happens to you, but it's what you do with it that counts. How he was able to express himself and to continue to move forward every single day in his life, even to this moment, is truly an inspiration to all of us. Because we all have challenges in our lives. We all have the sovereignty to hold fast to our attitude about how we view those challenges. And in spite of pain and suffering and disability, we have the ability to keep hope, to look for inspiration and unleash ability with every breath we have. That's why I'd like to congratulate absolutely everyone here tonight who has played a role in helping to open the Stephen Hawking Center at the Perimeter Institute. This is an incredible and monumentous occasion, and I can't be prouder as a Canadian to know that it's hosted here in Canada. The legacies that will come forward will have new discoveries and insights that will absolutely change the world. But it will also, by virtue of carrying Stephen's name, inspire every student and every person who learns about this center to believe in themselves, to chase goals, to dream big, to never give up on their dreams.
Some great words there from Rick Hansen. And I think it's no surprise that Stephen Hawking has been such an inspiring example. I think what might be a surprise for many people, though, and Neil, maybe you can speak to this as well, we're going to hear from Stephen Hawking in just a moment, but his own view of his disability is maybe not what we would expect. So let's hear from him first.
All of my life, I have sought to understand the universe. I have been very lucky that my disability has not been a serious handicap. Indeed, it has probably given me more time than most people to pursue the quest for knowledge.
Wow, so here we have Stephen Hawking saying that his disability has not really impaired him from doing physics. Neil, I want to ask you, this is a really interesting point. Do you think it has changed the way he does physics?
Yeah, absolutely.
How?
When you do physics, there are kind of two ways you can do it. One, you can sit down and do long and hard calculations, very detailed. It's very important work, but it's to some extent mechanical. And these are extremely complex and difficult calculations. And I know because I've read Stephen's thesis that he prepared as a grad student, that is what he was doing before he became more handicapped. The other kind of work you can do is the more conceptual work. And you can really think about the foundations. How does the subject work? What problems can I tackle and how? And you can find collaborators who work with you and do the complex technical calculations. And I definitely see that in Stephen's work, his handicap led him to the more foundational thought. And his insights that he made in the 70s were truly staggering. The way in which he conceived of gravity, how to calculate the properties of black holes. And I think his handicap led him to pursue directions of calculation which would be most direct. So he just didn't have the option of the complicated way of doing it. So he had to have the insight to see the shortcut to the answer. And at the time he did those calculations, people were very skeptical, said, you know, because his shortcut, not everyone else could see mm-hmm. that was correct. And as time has gone on, people have, you know, appreciated his insights more and more. But, you know, he is just the most unbelievably positive person. And I've been with him in all kinds of situations where, and Jim knows him well too. This is somebody whose health has just plagued him. He's been in and out of hospital. He's had accidents, broken bones, you name it. And he just marches on regardless, with a very clear focus on what he wants to do.
And physics is different as a result.
Completely.
He's done, absolutely. Yeah. So this idea of the conceptual, back to you, Rebecca, because I'm still curious about what it is that's going on. Now, you have a special insight into the world of theoretical physics because Rebecca happens to be married to a theoretical physicist. So I'm going to try not to put you in trouble at home, but you know, we've been talking about the brain in a general way when it does physics, but obviously it's a talent that some have pursued more than others, some have trained and nurtured. So when physicists are in a room and they're doing physics, let's talk about what's lighting up. What is actually happening?
Physics in particular. I think physics, theoretical physics, is interesting in some of the ways that Neil has said, that you can come at it in many different ways. You can come at it from abstract symbol manipulation that looks more like the way we think about math. You can come at it from an intuition about the way the world works and the way the universe kind of runs. You can come at it from a more sort of language-based strategy or a more spatial strategy. So it seems like you could come to the problems of theoretical physics in many different ways. And I guess part of what's going on there is a desire to understand the basic causes of our universe, the causal origins, which is a pursuit maybe followed by theoretical physicists in a distinct way, but that has, I think, its origins in something very universal about human cognition. You know, one thing that my own field of cognitive neuroscience has been interested in the last few years is that people used to think that children started with very concrete ideas and that the abstract came later, that it was hard to think in the abstract. And what we've been learning recently is that actually it comes completely naturally to human children and human infants to think in the abstract, that they see things as causally related before they, you know, understand almost anything about the details. So kids and infants are approaching the world as being made up of interesting, deep causes and seeking those causes all the way through infancy. And so some people in my field would say that physicists have just stayed children.
Right. Now you really are in trouble.
Thanks, Ivan.
But there's a tough question here, which is, I mean, if it's the pursuit of the basic, and if it's something that we seem to be wired for, if it goes back to such an early stage in development, why is it so hard?
Well, it's hard to get the answer right. So the pursuit, but I guess it's hard to get the answer right because it's a very fundamental answer you're looking for, right? The universe around us is incredibly detailed and complex, and the correct answer from theoretical physics seeks to explain everything, right? It's not like it would be enough to get it about right, to get the trains on time, to make the phone work. You know, if you think about it, we sent a tin can to the moon, right? That's how accurate we were. And theoretical physicists say, yeah, we can throw something from Earth and hit the moon, right? But that's not good enough. We want to be even more exactly right than that. So I guess what I would say is, it wasn't, you set a boundary. If you get there, it's not like we're satisfied. We just move the boundary on. So what makes it hard is maybe the constant dissatisfaction that we bring to the problem, which is exactly what Julie was describing. We just make it harder for ourselves. If somebody has already climbed the moon, climbed Everest, somebody else is going to be the first blind man to climb Everest.
There you go. All right. Well, we make it hard for ourselves, and in doing so, we challenge ourselves. So now, why don't we once again hear from another fan of Stephen Hawking, now coming to us from a creative domain beyond science.
Hello, everyone. I'm David Foster. You know, I've always been fascinated with ideas, their creation, their execution, and their power to open up a world of possibilities. To me, Professor Hawking is the ultimate embodiment of the power of ideas. Of course, he's been an inspiration to millions around the world, including me. And I'm so pleased to join everyone gathered here tonight to celebrate the official opening of the Stephen Hawking Center at the Perimeter Institute. Well, it's often said that building is little more than bricks, mortar, and glass. What makes this center truly unique is the ideas that will be generated within its walls. Ideas, I'm convinced, that will help solve some of the world's most pressing challenges in the years to come. Congratulations to all of you, and especially to Mr. Hawking.
Great thought there from David Foster. What's interesting to me about his tribute is that he's starting from the world of creativity and ideas and moving to this issue of solving some of the world's most pressing challenges. Not surprisingly, this is also something that Stephen Hawking has addressed over the years. Because of his stature, people have been interested in his take on human survival and science and its application to human survival. Let's hear again from Stephen Hawking on one aspect of this that I think will be close to Julie's heart.
If we are the only intelligent beings in the galaxy, we should make sure we survive and continue. But we are entering an increasingly dangerous period in our history. Our only chance of long-term survival is not to remain inward-looking on planet Earth, but to spread out into space. That is why I am in favor of manned, or should I say, personed, space flight.
There we have it, Stephen Hawking in favor of personed space flight, and actually not perhaps a bit of a surprise. Certainly the cost of human space flight is something that's often debated. There's an interesting distinction here, though, Julie. We were talking earlier about sort of that deep-seated need to explore, to go places where people haven't been before. So there's knowledge for knowledge's sake or exploration for exploration's sake. But here we also have a second thought, which is that this activity is also essential to our survival. So first of all, I want to ask you personally, I mean, as someone who's been involved in space exploration, do you also feel that in some way, do you agree with Dr. Hawking, that that's somehow key to human survival somewhere down the road?
Well, it's an interesting thought that indeed something would happen to the planet to the point where we would all be obliterated and there would be no single survivor. I'm very much a statistics and probability person, and I don't think that even a catastrophe would absolutely eliminate every single human being. So I'm not so worried about the survivability of the human race in the long term. That certainly is not the reason we drive exploration. That drive will always be there. We know also that exploration brings back benefits. You discover, you learn, but you are also able to exploit a larger area, a bigger playground. I think that we will continue to expand. There's, if it's not tomorrow, it'll be in a millennium from now that we'll reach other places. The other thing Stephen Hawking said, though, is that if we are the only form of life in the universe, well, that's a big if. And that is a fundamental question. And one of the reasons we explore today is to answer that. The day we're going to find a single microorganism or a bacteria on another planet or on an asteroid or on a meteorite that would have fallen on the Earth, we will have the answer to this question. But until then, we do not know.
That's right. And I guess if we ever are, to go even one step further, if we're ever able to pick up a signal or somehow make contact with some other kind of intelligence that could be out there somewhere in the galaxy, if such a thing were possible, I suppose one of the ways that we would be able to communicate with them, obviously, we wouldn't have language, but we would be able to, in some way, compare physics. Would physics become our common language?
If not physics, I think mathematics.
I suspect that that is a universal language for any species in this universe. Our name, by the way, is Homo sapien, wise man. And we could perhaps say even wiser women. But wise...
Not to be confused with wise guys.
Not to be confused. Are you from New Jersey? But this concept, I mean, our name says it, wise man. Our wisdom is, in fact, involving unraveling the mysteries of the universe. That's why we are wise. And I don't see how, and I would disagree with my co-panelists in one way, because you said it's difficult to conceive of an event that would totally destroy our species. But dinosaurs had such an event happen to them, apparently. And so it's not inconceivable to me. And so one of the things I think that is really important for scientists to recognize that over the span of millennia, we could have existential threats to this species. And if the species is to survive, I think those tools will have to come from science. So I think that there is a moral commitment to our millennially long survival that the doing of science, I think, is just absolutely critical.
An essential part of what it is to be human, and certainly Stephen Hawking has been an essential part of physics today over the course of what has been perhaps one of the most exciting periods in the history of that science. We have one more statement from Professor Hawking this evening who's going to leave us with one more thought. So let's hear from him one last time about what it's actually like to be participating in physics today.
It has been a glorious time to be alive and doing research in theoretical physics. Our picture of the universe has changed a great deal in the last 40 years, and I'm happy if I have made a small contribution. I want to share my excitement and enthusiasm.
Well, there we go. And on that enthusiastic note, our hour has actually come to an end. But certainly it's given us plenty to think about. So before we leave you, I do want to thank our panel again for their enthusiasm about Stephen Hawking and his ideas. And our panel once again is James Gates, Professor of Physics, University of Maryland, Rebecca Sachs, Cognitive Neuroscientist, MIT, Julie Payette, Canadian Astronaut, and Neil Turek, Physicist and Director of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics here in Waterloo, in Ontario. My name is Ivan Semenik. Thanks to all of you for joining us today. Now go out there and think big.